Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to start the show today by talking with you about an amazing animal, the beaver. Beavers are capable of fighting floods. They can fight droughts. And you're going to learn a whole lot more about them as we visit with our guest, Ben Goldfarb. He has a new book out. It's called Eager: The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. Ben's an award-winning environmental journalist who covers wildlife conservation, marine science, and public lands management. Holds a master's of environmental management from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And is a 2018 North American Congress for Conservation Biology Journalist Fellow. Beavers are pretty amazing creatures, and I hope you'll join in with your questions about them or maybe your experiences with them. We have plenty of beavers here in Wisconsin for sure. Sometimes they benefit a person's landscape. Sometimes they create problems. Sometimes those problems can be solved. Sometimes they can't. Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Ben Goldfarb with us by phone. Ben, hello. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Larry. I appreciate it.
You know, when I was in first grade, early in the year of first grade in my school, Hope School, Mrs. Dahl, my teacher, Eleanor Dahl, she's a wonderful teacher, but she had a skull of a beaver. And she, I have no idea how she got it, but she pulled the teeth out, the tooth, you could pull it out, and it was like, my memory was like 4 or 5 inches long, and she talked about how beavers need to keep chewing so that the teeth don't go through the roof of their mouth. So I've had a long time interest in beavers. How the heck did you get interested in them?
Yeah, I wish I had a first grade teacher as beaver aware as yours. my own beaver introduction. I live out in the state of Washington, and a few years back, you know, I'd always been kind of a beaver fan, but you know, my true obsession began when I met a beaver biologist, this guy named Kent Woodruff, who works for the Metau Beaver Project in the Metau Valley in central Washington. And what they do is they basically live trap nuisance beavers, you know, beavers that are cutting down people's apple trees or clogging up road culverts or flooding crops or what have you. And they live trap those beavers and they relocate them to places that don't have beavers and that could use some. And it was going out with Kent and his crew and seeing some of these relocation sites where beavers had taken, you know, these little thin trickles of water and transformed them into these incredible, lush, life-filled wetlands that were storing huge amounts of water in central Washington, you know, which is kind of on the east side of the Cascade, so it's a pretty dry landscape. And, you know, these beavers were basically creating these invaluable reservoirs in this pretty dry region. So it was really going out with those guys and just seeing how useful beavers could be from a water storage standpoint that got me really excited about these super cool rodents.
And they really are amazing. I've been fortunate. I have with some buddies of mine, and I have a cabin in northern Wisconsin. It's right next to the Shawamigan National Forest. And so I've spent the last more than 20 years observing beavers in the National Forest and what they've done to a particular area that I like to go to and spend time in. And it's amazing how a landscape changes or can change, I thought for the better, in the midst of the Shawamigan National Forest over an extended period of time. It was really fun to watch year after year.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great things about them, you know, is that it's so hard to sort of observe geological processes in action, right? You can't see, you know, the Rocky Mountains rising or, you know, the glaciers scouring out valleys. But beavers, you know, beavers are this way of observing changes to landscapes within a single human lifetime. You know, that's one of the really cool things I love about them too, is, you know, you can sort of watch these almost geological processes unfold in, you know, in a few months or a few years. It's sort of like it's real-time landscape change. I love that about beavers.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed your book. You have wonderful stories and backed up with a lot of interesting research on beavers as well. What surprised you the most about beavers? That you learned?
Oh man, that's a great question. I think that for me, the thing that was most striking was just the incredible sort of scope of historic beaver influence on North American landscapes. You know, I think that when I started working on this book, you know, I'm a fly fisherman, and I spend lots of time, you know, standing in streams, and yeah. My sort of ideal conception of a stream was again this kind of free flowing, straight, thin trickle that you could, you know, leap or wade right across, right? And that's a perfect stream, right? Something you'd see in an Orvis catalog. And you know, when you read about early explorers and trappers crossing North America, you know, you realize that not a whole lot of streams really looked like that. You know, that beaver influence was really much more the rule than the exception. That, you know, that our landscape was just so wet and ponded and marshy and beaver dominated, you know. So I think that was really shocking to me. It was like, you know, reading about explorers crossing the state of Indiana and not finding a dry place to camp for 100 miles because it was so beaver dominated. You know, that was just stunning to me, to kind of the depth of the historic influence before, of course, we virtually exterminated them during the fur trade.
Yeah, and how many were, I remember reading in your book, but of course I've forgotten, how many beavers were estimated to be here sort of before we started eradicating them, and how many we're left with?
Yeah, you know, we don't have a perfect estimate. We just have some kind of guesses, but the best guess is that we had somewhere between 60 and 400 million beavers in North America, so as many as 400 million. And by 1900, after 3 centuries of unabated trapping, we were down to about 100,000 in all of North America. So, you know, a pretty dramatic decline. And that was true in Wisconsin, too. In Wisconsin, there were fewer than 500 beavers left by the turn of the century. So pretty significant numbers and pretty pretty disastrous declines.
Yeah, for sure. But we've got more than 500 in Wisconsin right now. I can tell you that for free, Ben. Oh man. Well, they're certainly fun animals to watch. I've observed those beavers in the Shawabigan National Forest on one just enormous dam that they built and lodge that you walk right out on. I think you could drive a car out on it they're fascinating creatures. Ben Goldfarb, our guest today, by the way, he's author of Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And you know what? Let's take a call. Lisa in Winona, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. I got a story for you. Okay, I fish pretty much in the same spot every day where they have a pump house and the washout, you know what I mean, along the river, the washout tubes and the cement wall. Well, all of a sudden this beaver showed up there one day, and I named him Charlie. And pretty soon he'd get closer to me and closer to me. I didn't know what to do, if I should run or not, but I didn't. And then he'd give me a show. He'd swim by with a big stick. And then he'd come back doing the backstroke on his back, pulling the big stick. And then he'd go forward again, pulling the stick. Then he'd come back on his back, pulling the stick, like he was giving me a show. And then before you know it, he was down in that pipe hole. Every time I came down there, he'd come out and just sit by me.
Oh.
And he had blue eyes.
Wow.
I got pictures of him. I'm serious. This is the neatest thing, Charlie. I nicknamed him Charlie.
Lisa,
and then he just disappeared one day, and I haven't seen him since.
Oh, well, that's kind that's kind of too bad. Ben, I know you've had a different kind of experience with beavers, but go ahead. Have you had anything like that or heard of anything like that?
Well, yeah, you know, I think that in areas that get pretty regular human use, they can definitely get super acclimated to people. You know, I was living in Massachusetts a couple of years ago, and there was a beaver pond with a giant beaver lodge, and people would actually fish for bass off of the beaver lodge. They'd stand on the lodge and cast from there, and the beavers would come out in the evening, and you know, they would They would chew down trees and do maintenance on their lodge, even as people were fishing on top of their home. In places that get regular human use, usually beavers are pretty shy and retiring and avoid people. They're generally nocturnal, but it does seem like in certain spots they can get quite acclimated to human presence. That's pretty cool that you had that experience with Charlie. I love that.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa. Thanks very much for calling. You mentioned fishing, and there's some pretty good brook trout fishing in northern Wisconsin in certain spots where the beavers have kind of dammed up areas and allow the brookies to thrive a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I mean, Wisconsin is among the beaver believers, the real dyed-in-the-wool beaver lovers who believe that beavers can solve many of our ecological problems. I am one of those beaver believers. The Wisconsin approach to beaver management is it's pretty controversial because there is lots of evidence suggesting that beavers create great brook trout habitat. I've fished for brook trout in behind beaver dams and in beaver ponds. But there is lots of beaver removal and dam removal conducted in Wisconsin to kind of keep streams free flowing. The idea being that that beaver dams can create barriers for trout, and that these beaver ponds warm up the water to levels that can be deleterious to trout. So there's lots of beaver removal in Wisconsin for the sake of trout. And that's a kind of a controversial program within the beaver believer cult, I would say.
Yeah. And you really talk a lot about the fact the work that's been done to kind of let nature take its course and the positive impacts that that approach can have.
Yeah, I mean, there's just an incredible wealth of evidence about how beavers benefit all kinds of creatures. We know that moose love to cool off in beaver ponds and eat the aquatic vegetation that grows there. We know beaver ponds create incredible habitat for all kinds of waterfowl, for amphibians, for black bears. It's almost hard to name a species that doesn't benefit from beavers in some way. Out west where I live, beavers and salmon is sort of the hot topic right now.
Yeah.
Beavers create these fantastic pools and side channels and sort of complex habitat that's really good for juvenile salmon. So that's a lot of the beaver restoration that's happening in the Northwest now is being driven by salmon recovery. Just the incredible menagerie of species that rely on beavers in some way. It's hard to imagine a species that doesn't benefit from these incredible pond and wetland habitats.
Mark in Washburn has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I was wondering if your guest has done any research into the megafauna that lived 15,000 years ago. The beavers were purportedly 500 pounds. And I'm wondering what kind of dams they built.
You've got a photo in your book, if I'm not mistaken, from the Badlands.
Right. So it's interesting. So today, we have just two different species of beaver in the world. We've got the North American beaver, Castor canadensis, and there's the Eurasian beaver, Castor fiber, which lives, of course, in Europe and Asia. But historically, as the caller says, there was this kind of this amazing diversity of beavers, including these beavers that were nearly the size of black bears that lived in North America, all over the continent, until just 10 to 15,000 years ago. And actually, lots of Native American tribes actually have historic cultural memories, oral histories about these giant beavers, which is kind of cool. The big question is whether those giant beavers, Castoroides was the genus of those black bear-sized beavers. The big question is whether Castoroides actually built dams or not, or whether it just kind of lived like a hippo almost, sort of lounging around in ponds and eating vegetation. So we don't actually know whether those beavers built dams, and scientists are still trying to figure that out. The beavers that Larry's alluding to that are mentioned in the book, are these sort of one of the earliest beavers that lived about 20 million years ago, called paleocaster. And those beavers were almost more like prairie dogs. They dug these giant spiral-shaped burrows that they excavated with their front teeth. They kind of chiseled their way down into the ground in these giant sort of helices that definitely confused subsequent scientists when they stumbled upon these crazy fossilized corkscrews. So historically, we had all kinds of crazy beavers on this continent, and now we're just down to the North American beaver.
Thanks a lot for that question. There's an amazing photo in your book of this guy in the Badlands standing next to one of these mounds and corkscrews, and it's an amazing photo and amazing what they could do. Golly.
Yeah.
Ben, go ahead, Ben.
Well, I was going to say, one of the funny things about that is that, you know, there were sort of left-tooth beavers and right-tooth beavers. And some of these giant corkscrews were clockwise, and some were counterclockwise, and they definitely confused the first scientists who saw them.
Ben Goldfarb, our guest today, his book, Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. Great having him on, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network. Talking today with Ben Goldfarb, author of the book Eager, the Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. It's a fascinating book. I'm really glad to have Ben with us today. If you have a question, a comment, or maybe an experience to share, join in, 800-642-1234. Myra in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance now. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was just up in Alaska on a fishing trip down the Kinnickock River, and we saw two types of lodges. One was right on the river edge, and one was the lodges in the back were huge, like small houses. At one point, we saw a grizzly standing up on top of one, and he didn't look as big as he should have. So, yeah, as long as he was standing there and not in my campsite, I was fine. But I'm wondering, the guide was saying that some build on the edge and some prefer lodges. So I'm wondering if those are two different types, and how old are these huge lodges, and how many beavers live in these huge lodges?
Ben, great comment.
It's a great question, yeah. And that sounds like a fantastic trip. I'm very jealous. So as you say, there are basically two types of beaver lodges. There's the bank lodges, which are the ones that are sort of built into the riverbank on the edge, as you say. And then there's sort of the island lodges, which is what we think about when we think about a beaver lodge, you know, this kind of this freestanding structure in a pond. And then there are also beavers that elect not to build a lodge at all. They'll just sort of burrow directly into a river or stream or lake bank, and there'll be really no visible structure. And those are all the same beavers. You know, it's just they're not, you know, there aren't different types of beavers that build different types of lodges. It just kind of depends on the circumstance, whether they feel like a lodge is necessary or appropriate. And of course, the point of the lodge is just it's this house where they can shelter from predators and be safe and also be warm, of course. And you know, occasionally bears do break in there, so maybe that grizzly that you saw was trying to tear into one. As for how many beavers live in a lodge, you know, typical colony is 4 to 6. You can get as many as 10 in a single lodge, and that's generally, you know, the mating pair, the parents who mate for life. And then you get, you know, the newborn kits, which are born in the spring, and then, you know, the one-year-olds and the two-year-olds. And the two-year-olds are sort of sometime during their second year, they'll disperse off and go find their own territories, kind of like, you know, teenagers heading off to work or college or something like that. So 4 to 6 beavers in a lodge, I think, is pretty typical, but you can get more than that sometimes.
And if you want to know what it sounds like inside those lodges, Dave Potratz, our engineer, found some sounds. Isn't that cool? That's a recording from inside a lodge.
That's fantastic.
Isn't that fantastic?
And you can hear that. You can go to a lodge and in the evening and put your ear close to the wall and you often will hear those noises.
Oh, cool. Colette in River Falls up next. Colette, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I listen to you all the time. I had an unusual. I and my family and neighbors had an unusual encounter with the beaver. I live above the gorge of the Kinnikinnick River, very close to the Kinnikinnick State Park. And I was just outside working in my garden. I looked toward the highway, and there, walking along the side of the highway, and I'm on the gorge. I'm above the gorge, so it's a steep climb up for a long way. Was a beaver just walking along the side of the road, and no one believed me. And I went over there and grabbed my husband and dragged him over. And then we didn't see him. And then he showed up in my neighbor's yard. Well, we gathered all the neighbors in a garbage can, and we chased the beaver into a garbage can, dragged him back down the gorge, and let him back go into the Kinnikinnick River. We're probably a mile from where it joins the St. Croix River. Could that have been one of those young beavers who were confused and leaving home? Because to have it out in the open in the middle of the day, up on top of the ridge, above the gorge, seemed very unusual.
Well, it might have been a two-year-old. Ben, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good guess. You know, beavers are very territorial, so it can often be hard for one of those dispersing two-year-olds to find an unoccupied place to set up a lodge and a dam complex. And that's, you know, that's when they're most vulnerable, of course, is when they're wandering around looking for their next home. You know, you see beaver roadkill by streams pretty frequently. That's when they're susceptible to predators like, you know, black bears, coyotes, wolves, cougars in places that have cougars. So yeah, it's definitely possible you saw a two-year-old, and I'm glad that you guys sort of shoot him into that garbage can, because that can be kind of a tough experience for a two-year-old trying to find a new territory.
Thanks, Colette. Appreciate the call. You know, just the anatomy of beavers, before we go back to the phones, is really amazing there. You talk about the density of their hair as an example, and also you talk about the tail and its purpose. So talk a little about that.
Yeah, beavers, you know, of course, they're these semi-aquatic rodents, and they're really well adapted to that very unique niche they fill. So, of course, if you're going to spend a lot of your life in the water, you know, you need to have dense fur to stay warm. And beavers actually have as many individual hairs on a patch of skin the size of a postage stamp as we humans have on our entire head. So incredibly dense fur. And, of course, that was what led to their downfall, was that their fur just made these fantastic, sort of durable, malleable, waterproof hats. So that was, you know, that was sort of the fur. Their fur is of course, this critical adaptation to living in the water, but it was also, the reason they were nearly wiped out in the first place. And then their tail, of course, is this amazing appendage. It's, I'm sure many of your listeners have heard a beaver tail slap in the classic beaver warning signal. They also use it as a fat storage device. So just as a bear will put on weight for the winter, beavers actually put on fat in their tails. And it also has sort of this thermoregulatory function. They can actually exchange hot and cold through these specialized blood vessels in their tails to kind of moderate their body temperature. So the tail is a really, really unique organ, basically. And I'm sure muskrats are really jealous.
And I've heard that slap many times. It's really, really very cool. And it's, as you say, it's difficult in the book. You say it's difficult to tell which one's the male and which one's the female because of the way they are put together.
Right. So male beavers have internal genitalia, which makes sense. I mean, if you're an animal that spends its entire life swimming around log jams, you don't really want a little dangling appendage that you can get snagged on things, right? It's not really hydrodynamic to have external genitalia. So beavers, they keep it all tucked up, and that makes it basically impossible, unless the female is lactating, to tell a male from a female at a glance. So the way that you sex a beaver, and this is really like news you can use right here, is you basically have to, the beavers, they're very scent-oriented animals. They mark their territories with these scent glands. They have two different sets of scent glands. And what you have to do is basically squeeze one of these scent glands, which is, kind of this little pink nubbin of flesh, and then smell the scent secretion that squirts out. And if it smells like motor oil, it's a male beaver. If it smells like old cheese, it's a female beaver. So now you guys all know, in case this ever arises in your daily life, you now know how to sex a beaver.
Dave Potretz, the next time you run into a beaver and you want to sex him, now you know how to do it. There we go.
Yeah, be careful.
You tell a story near the end of I think it was you that went into a, a beaver that, well, tell that story.
Sure, yeah. So one of the chapters of the book takes place in England. In England and Scotland, where they're reintroducing these Eurasian beavers after hundreds of years of being wiped out, and so I went to visit one of these beavers that was about to be reintroduced, and I kind of got into the enclosure with this beaver, and the beaver started growling at me, which is a sound that I hadn't really heard a beaver make, and then the beaver sort of lunged at me and just nipped me in the ankle. It was sort of like a little warning nip, but they can do some damage. There is actually one recorded beaver caused human fatality, which is a fisherman in Belarus. A few years ago, who picked up a beaver to take a picture with it, and the beaver severed an artery in his leg. So, they're generally pretty docile creatures, but just don't handle beavers. Okay,
it's not a good thing.
Animals. Don't go picking up wild animals.
And an adult, what do they weigh? An adult male might go 50 pounds.
Yeah, 50 or 60 pounds is pretty typical. And actually, the largest beaver in history ever recorded was actually caught in Wisconsin, and I believe that beaver was 129 pounds. So I'm not sure that we have beavers that hefty today, but Wisconsin is the world record holder.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's go to Neil in Milwaukee next. Neil, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, Larry, thanks for taking my call. Ben, your book sounds fascinating. I teach conservation at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Oh, cool.
Your book is definitely something I want to add to my library. We've got beaver right in Milwaukee. We've got several just north of downtown on the Milwaukee River. As you said, they don't always build dams. Sometimes they just build a hut into the side of the riverbank. But I heard a great story last week from one of my alumni. Waukesha County, which is just outside of Milwaukee, in their parks department, had a beaver built a dam on a small stream, and unfortunately...
Oh, nuts, we lost our caller. Oh, darn. Call back, and we got to call back, and we'll finish that story, because I want to hear that story. Oh, my goodness me. Well... So here, at least if he isn't able to get back in, here you've got beaver living in the most populous city in our state. Half the population of the state practically lives in Milwaukee area.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the cool things about beavers is that they're actually, as long as you don't, actively kill them, they can do pretty well in these pretty urban areas. These days there are beavers in the Bronx River in New York City. There are beavers in various downtowns in the Bay Area in California. One of the places I went during this book, I went to a Walmart in Logan, Utah that had beavers living basically in the parking lot.
That was really cool story.
Yeah. It's very neat how beavers, as much as I love beavers, I'm not naive about how challenging they can be. They can certainly cause a lot of a lot of trouble. But, you know, as long as you're willing to live with those impacts or you know, mitigate them in some way, you know, you can really we can really coexist with beavers in some pretty developed landscapes.
You talk about a guy, Joe Wheaton, I think, who actually does a lot of work like that, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. Joe is at Utah State University, and exactly, you know, his whole deal is, you know, basically trying to figure out ways that we can reintroduce beavers and these really beneficial complex habitats they create back into our lives. You know, and I mean, one technique that lots of beaver conservationists and restorationists espouse is this thing called a flow device, right? So beaver caused flooding is a big problem, right? We all know that. We all know somebody who's had a beaver, you know, flood their property. And, you know, usually the way that those kinds of conflicts are handled is just trapping the beaver out, which, you know, in certain situations is certainly necessary and appropriate. But, you know, there are other situations where, you know, we can mitigate that problem through some kind of non-lethal way. And the method that, you know, that's often used is this flow device, which is basically kind of a system of pipes and fences. You often hear it called a beaver deceiver that basically, you know, sneaks water out of the pond. So you can put the pipe through the beaver dam or through a road culvert if flooding near a road is an issue, and basically regulate the height of that pond. So you're maintaining enough of a pond for the beavers to remain in place, but you know, not so much. The water level is not so high that you know you're having your property flooded. So it's sort of a compromise between humans and rodents. And there have been some great studies basically showing how effective those kinds of systems are and how beneficial they can be for the environment.
Yeah, Tom in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Tom, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to. I have a question and a comment. The comment. This one time I met a beaver when I was fly fishing in western Wisconsin, and I thought I saw a log behind me downstream, kind of caught in an eddy. But as I moved upstream, the log kept following. and I looked again and looked carefully, and it was definitely a beaver. So I keep going. He's not paying attention to me that much. And then a short while later, he was gone. And then he slapped the water right behind me with his tail. I almost went out of the stream. It was absolutely amazing. I mean, he was pretty aggressive coming that close. He was within inches. So that's the comment. It was really fun. But the question I have is, I understand that they're farming beavers in Canada for the fur industry. Is that true? And I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling, Tom.
You know, I know nothing about that. it's certainly possible there are beaver farms up in Canada. I've never heard of them. I don't know. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, that's worth looking into. Bob in Madison, we'll go to you next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks. Love the topic. Love the show. First time caller. I wanted to talk about a couple incidents we had with beavers, and then I have a question for you, if I may. We have beaver infestation up by our cottage in northern Wisconsin, and we actually went up there the other year, and we actually thought a tornado went through because we had so many trees down. And I'm talking not saplings. I did an inaccurate ring count of about 90 rings on these hardwood trees. And in addition to that, they dammed up the stream between two lakes, which affected not only the fishing and the massive property damage with the trees that they destroyed, but it also flooded our area, increased the mosquito population. It was really bad. So we, unfortunately, we have a perfect spot for beaver, but we have to kill them. We have to kill them. I mean, there's just no way we could handle that much property damage. So, which leads me to my question, other than the DNR, what is a good way to find trappers to get rid of them?
Well, Ben, do you have an answer to that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm sure that there is, you know, there's a Wisconsin Trappers Association that would provide you somebody. And you know, it's like I say, I certainly recognize that these these animals can be problematic. I would just say that the challenge that you're going to face there, of course, is that when you trap out a family of beavers, you're basically putting up a vacancy sign for the next family of beavers. And Northern Wisconsin is a very beavery place. It sounds like, as you said, you have perfect beaver habitat with, you know, two lakes connected by a stream with this fantastic hardwood food resource for them. They're just going to be back there, year after year. So, you know, I guess one of the big reasons I sort of advocate beaver coexistence in many cases rather than trapping is because, you know, trapping is just sort of this endless cycle that will, you'll just have to be ready to sort of trap this area pretty much in perpetuity, I think. So, you know, if the issue is flooding, it might be worthwhile to look into one of those flow devices I described, a pipe and fence system that, you know, that can kind of keep some of the water off your property there. From a tree standpoint, if you're worried about, the loss of valuable trees, it's certainly possible to just cage those with wire, basically. And I would encourage you guys, all the listeners out there, to check out a website called the Beaver Institute, which is run by this guy named Mike Callahan in Massachusetts, who's sort of one of the world's leaders in beaver coexistence. And, Mike contracts with trappers. There are situations where, you know, even he acknowledges that, you know, that beavers have to be eliminated. But I do think there are lots of opportunities to keep these animals on the landscape, especially in situations like that caller's where they're clearly going to be back basically in perpetuity. So the Beaver Institute, I would encourage you guys to take a look at.
Well, it is amazing that the opportunities that can be there for, I'm going back to the Walmart story. I mean, they just kept, they trap, and then the next year they'd have to trap again. The next year, they'd have to trap again, and then they figured out a way to actually live with the beavers.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And again, I mean, there are always going to be some sites, especially near roads where, you know, you just can't tolerate any flooding whatsoever, and you have to get the beavers out of there. But again, exactly as you say, I think there are lots of low hanging fruit out there. You know, situations or conflict points that we're currently managing via trapping that, you know, maybe we could try a different approach that would, you know, would let the beavers remain in place and, you know, create some of those really valuable benefits. Also, one other thing that caller brought up was the mosquito issue created by beavers.
Yeah.
And that's something that I often hear people ask about, is whether beavers are going to increase mosquito population. And actually, there's only been one study done of beavers and mosquitoes, and it actually found that beavers dramatically reduce mosquito populations. And, you know, part of the reason for that is that they're just creating these sort of deep habitats that that aren't great for mosquito larvae. There's also the fact that, you know, when beavers enter an area, you know, they're creating habitat for all of these creatures that eat mosquitoes, right? For all of these songbirds love sort of the shrubby habitat around beaver ponds, amphibians like frogs and salamanders, fish, of course, which eat mosquito larvae and eggs. So there's actually, you know, I don't dispute that this particular situation, you could see an increase in mosquitoes. I guess that's possible. But I think that in general, beavers are actually good mosquito reduction devices.
Well, Ben, you've written a fascinating book, and it's really a lot of fun talking with you about beavers, and I hope we have a chance to visit again. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and thanks for all of the great calls.
Yeah, Ben Goldfarb, our guest, and the author of his book is Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. God, it's really fascinating. And there, Dave's got us some, there's some beavers in their lodge right now. Well, I tell you what, we're going to move out of the lodge and we're going to move into some other waters here in the state and talk with you next about an organization that really helps all of us on our waters, the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary Flotilla. A couple of guests coming up to talk about that next here on the Ideas Network.